Like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer, because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I'm joined once again by my co-host, Hale. What we'll be discussing today, or specifically what we'll be reading and commenting on throughout the episode, is a short essay from... It's actually the eponymous essay of a collection of essays by the Canadian philosopher and poet Jan Zwicky. And the essay is titled Once Upon a Time in the West, which it sounds kind of ominous, but once we get into the essay itself, it actually plays itself out pretty well. It's an interesting take on the history of modern philosophy in the West, I'll definitely say. And we'll get into why that is very shortly. But just to start off the episode, I thought we would start with our usual quote and quandary. We'll just put some stuff on the table and then get into our reading and comments on Zwicky's essay.
The main event, yeah. Mm-hmm. The tasters before the main event.
The appetizers, yeah. I kind of think of them that way. So my quote, I think you have a quandary. I'll share my quote. My quote comes from a book called Metaphors We Live by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson, which is actually, it is a work of philosophy in a certain way, but it's ostensibly by linguists. George Lakoff and Mark Johnson are linguists. Yeah, it's definitely a book that philosophers have taken to using as a kind of linguistic resource, exploring the inherently metaphorical nature of language. And there's all kinds of, like, there's a huge, vast landscape of metaphors that they explore, and George and Lakoff and Johnson say constitute language. And this project of surveying language and its many mapped concepts and metaphors kind of gets its start with the later Wittgenstein, when he is doing his philosophical investigations and investigating the many uses of language and their relations to each other. But that starts getting... Lakoff and Johnson's book is a much more, like, kind of scientific, I suppose, approach to this relatively similar project. So the quote I have from this is actually not necessarily the point of the quote. I think this is what maybe makes how I read quotes not any more, like, interesting or anything like that. But I see, like, a kind of corollary to it. So I'll just read it and then I'll explain what I mean. So this is in a chapter on causation, and they're exploring the idea that causation might be, like, this, what they call, undecomposable primitive. And they say that's actually false. And they list several properties, and these properties form, again, in a very Wittgensteinian fashion, called a family resemblance. So they all relate to each other, but not in this clearly defined way. A proper understanding of causation requires that it be viewed as a cluster of other components, but the cluster forms a gestalt, a whole that we human beings find more basic than the parts. That's an interesting way to understand something, that a whole might be more basic than its parts. But what strikes me is this. They recur together, so the properties of causation, recur together over and over in action after action as we go through our daily lives. We experience them as a gestalt. That is, the complex of properties occurring together is more basic to our experience than their separate occurrence. Now, the key word here for me is to our experience, because when we think about things, we tend to come up against these very basic primitives, right? When we think about an idea, there are fundamental atomic ideas that you come up against composing something.
And so when you say, when you say primitive, like for me and for the listeners, I think you kind of hinted at there at atomic, as it's like we're talking about a concept or a component that is indivisible.
Yeah. Unanalyzable. So when we're doing it. Yeah, it's most fundamental. When we're doing analysis, we reach a sort of endpoint and we can go no further, right? But it's interesting that in thought, this seems possible, that wholes are composed of further things, which some of them are more unanalyzable. But it's interesting because that seems to be unique to the experience of thinking. But it might just be that, and this is why I say that the important part of this for me isn't necessarily like the metaphorical nature of it or anything like that, but it's highlighting that our experience of our daily lives might have a basic fundamental structure than the experience that we have in thinking, and that thinking might not, it's not the best tool for like thinking about our daily lives or anything like that, but its fundament just might be completely different. And so when we go looking for the most basic parts of our experiences in the experiences of thinking, we're looking in the wrong place.
To try and examine thinking, we end up sort of at this bedrock in itself. By virtue of the fact of trying to understand the thinking, you sort of get into this cyclical nature of thinking itself as being that very bedrock that we're trying to understand.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing too, just like kind of adding on top of this as well, and why I think this makes a lot of sense to me, is that one of the things that I learned from reading Hannah Arendt and her work, The Life of the Mind, is that there's actually like an asymmetrical relationship between our experiences of our daily lives and thinking, because on the one hand, we have all of this new stuff in our lives. You know, you turn a corner and it's hard not to see something new. There are all these appearances that just kind of, you have experiences of every day. Maybe you don't notice it, but you always are experiencing something new. But your capacity to think is supplied by that life, right? Thinking is always thinking about your experiences. It's always doubting or questioning or putting into speculation your experiences. So your daily life supplies the very content of your thoughts, right? So the relationship between the two is less symmetrical than I think, you know, like it's not just that we have like our lives and then our heads on the other side. And our philosophers have just elected to explore what's inside their head. Everything that's in there got there from one side, right? So that might have something to do with the fact that our daily lives have these gestalts, which are, again, complexes whose whole is more basic to than their parts. And it's only in thinking about those wholes that the parts become the fundaments, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's super interesting. I really like that quote. And it's, you know, and again, it's interesting. And again, it's one of those things that we often come across where it's like we can kind of touch upon through the quote itself, we can touch upon what the author is trying to get at, while at the same time also recognizing that what we're touching upon is that very limitation. Should we move on to my little quandary? I've got a little more of an emotive quandary, and obviously emotion is a kind of thinking You know, lately I think, like, I'm sure many of our listeners have felt the same way. It seems like the world is kind of there's the kind of archetype of the doomer, out there, that the world has gotten more and more cynical and aggressive and mean, right, in many kind of ways, especially in the kinds of media that we consume, but also in terms of the sort of people whose voices seem to be the loudest in our current cultural ethos, right? Whether that be political or in the realms of entertainment. You know, we've talked a lot before on the show about, you know, the nature of irony and its cynicism, and how you know, that culture has kind of moved away from that. And also, too, we've talked about, you know, the kind of new sincerity movement, you know, which we won't get into maybe too much here, but I know I've talked about in the past on episodes, you know, thinking about authors like David Foster Wallace and other artists and such like that, who, you know, try and ask us to take human experience and relationship seriously again, and perhaps not, that everything isn't necessarily a joke to be deconstructed or eye rolled at or whatever. And some of the media that I consume in my own nerdy way is a few different YouTubers. And I noticed how a couple of them that I really connect with, I really enjoy. One of the things I really enjoy about them is their emphasis on friendship with their viewing audience. Particularly, there's a channel called Ocean Liner Designs on YouTube. This is a very kind of like niche topic, but the YouTuber is called Mike Brady, and he reviews the kind of the golden age of ocean liners and ships and history of ships and stuff like that. You know, he's done a lot of work on, does a lot of episodes and things like the Titanic, but many others as well. But he always starts the episode by saying, you know, this is your friend Mike Brady with Ocean Liner Designs. There's another show as well that I watch quite a lot called Tasting History with Max Miller, where, again, he'll often refer to his audience as friends. And there's a certain degree of sincerity that it seems to be put out there by this kind of emphasis on friendship. Not that in fact you are a consumer of, you know, of my content, that you are a consumer of my entertainment, or that you're even a fan, but in fact, you know, we're individuals engaged in niche topics that, you know, and that we both love and enjoy, and love and enjoyment of these niche topics, whether it be, you know, the old boats, basically, you know, again, or Tasting History, it's, you know, a show about, you know, ancient food and making, you know, kind of go into making ancient meals were like, and how people used to eat, and then also, you know, making those meals today and stuff like that. And it really reminded me just basically of this kind of, well, like I said, this ethos of sincerity, this ethos of friendship, of basically taking a new stand and relationship between someone producing a ostensibly a form of content or of entertainment, but treating or viewing the audience as a friend rather than just a consumer or a vehicle, or ultimately a vehicle for monetary or social, you know, gain, right? And that arises from a recognition of a shared specific interest, right? Right? Like, you know, when this individual Mike Brady says, you know, it's your friend Mike Brady with Ocean Liner Designs, you know, I think it's something that sounds more meaningful because you are, you know, this isn't something that most people are that interested in. And obviously he's obsessed with it. And he's kind of assuming, hey, if you're on my channel and if you're watching my channel and if you're a supporter, well then, you know, we are, you know, that this is a vehicle, even if it's a friendship on some level of utility in the Aristotelian sense, there's also a friendship of almost a kind of love or even of virtue, you know, based on this sort of like mutual respect and admiration for the fact that we are, you know, people who are caring about and engaging in topics together in a sincere manner, right? That it's not, and again, and that's what I was kind of thinking is initially I was like, this is a friendship of utility. He's getting something from us and getting something from him. But it's like, but maybe there are ways in which creators like that are actually displaying friendships of love and virtue, because the main focus is the care and concern of the topic and the fact that it's a person, an individual who also has that same sort of love, care, and concern for that topic that brings us together, and we're not actually getting anything from each other in that same sort of way necessarily, but instead sharing a loved experience of knowledge in a specific kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah, this is an interesting phenomenon. Like, I was going to say that this, like, right off the bat, it seemed like this was going to be kind of an exploration of, you know, a very well-known phenomena of present media, which is things like parasocial relationships, right? The asymmetrical relationships which open up between people who have media platforms that have massive and expandingly massive audiences, and the relationship that those audience members have, or that one-way relationship that they have to those content creators or anything like that. It's interesting because I've always thought about I've always kind of like problematized that in terms of like, say, I don't know, I like read Spinoza or Aristotle or someone, and I feel like they're my friend because we're doing, you know, like, I feel like Spinoza understands me or something like that. Well, Spinoza doesn't know me, you know. But in any case, I think the case that you bring up here, though, is really interesting and sort of almost like softens the blow on that case as well, which is that it's one thing if, like, you're just watching, like, a drama YouTuber and they're, like, producing content in order to produce content, you know? It's a whole other thing if what they're doing is, you know, this really, really niche thing, like making a YouTube channel about ocean liners, and, you know, the algorithm is not very likely to serve that up to just like anyone. Most of the people there are probably like either searching it up or they have their own kind of like way that they found themselves to that channel. So there is something about the way that the viewer approaches that is different than just like making something for its own sake. And the other thing too, which I think is really important, is that like it's predicated upon a particular activity. And I think you did a really good job of seeing that those are things that can transcend utility in the, you know, the Aristotelian analysis. Aristotle says too specifically, you know, friends of character, what characterizes them is that they live together, right? They share a constitutive activity of their life. So when your YouTubers say friend, it's very possible that they mean it, because there might be a genuine community that actually opens up around these particular topics or activities or anything that they might be making their content around, right? In fact, they might actually just be like a pillar of, you know, the ocean liner internet community. If they were to close up shop, well, that would be it for people, you know, for the spaces where people could pursue that and live that life together, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's, you know, it comes down to sort of is, you know, we've talked about in the past, you know, so much cynicism has sort of seeped into the culture and culture, you know, we've talked about, you know, so many people, whether that be like Foster Wallace, we've talked before, or Mark Fisher and individuals like that talking about how, you know, the culture of irony, right? That you know, nothing is ever actually as it really seems. And so we never take it seriously because it's really always about, you know, capital and money and gain and stuff like that. But perhaps, you know, individuals like this are producing content and engaging with their audience in a way that, while like it might be their livelihood, the livelihood aspect really is secondary to the shared enjoyment, care, and concern, and frankly, love of a community of people who are, you know, interested in the same sorts of knowledge and enhancing each other's ability to engage with that kind of stuff and share with each other, right? And that knowledge and community would not be there without that kind of friendship. And that the money aspect, the financial aspect, maybe doesn't have to be the number one thing, right? It doesn't have to be the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting case with most of these kinds of creators you find is that, I mean, they're more or less doing what they've been doing the whole time, ever since they like kind of just started doing it for fun, and then they just got better at it, and then they got, you know, they started getting some ad revenue and stuff like that. So ultimately, they are still doing what they were always doing, which was just kind of like freely sharing the information that they have, opening up spaces for community and whatnot. So I think the hermeneutic of suspicion can always be applied to basically anything. But in any case, there's definitely a hermeneutic of faith that you can read into this as well, which I think is that these are people who, if they wanted to, they could, like, well, that's the thing, is they don't want to. So they're doing it because they want to do it, right?
There's ways, you know, and we'll jump into our main topic, but it was really emphasized to me even more because, you know, as a recent for my work, for our listeners, I received a work laptop, a laptop that was given to me, you know, because through the job that I do, right, it's provided to me by my employer. And I, you know, as I've occasionally gone on YouTube on this work laptop. Now that work laptop is completely separate from all the other sort of tech pieces of technology that I have. And so when I've gone on YouTube on there, it's been interesting to see what the sort of algorithm gives Bear with the base knowledge that it has. You know, I probably assuming things like IP address and stuff like that, so that they could assume I'm a Canadian located in this part of the world and such and such. But it doesn't have all the kind of background that my prior, you know, profiles and stuff would have. And the sorts of things that get recommended are far more what we would think of as sort of the classic kind of AI, Mr. Beast, in your face, very generated, entertainment, eye-grabby, fragmented, and far more, far less sincere, I would say, and far more cynical, oftentimes sort of either kind of rage bait, trickery content or whatever, which really is geared simply to gaining views. Like that is really what it's all about, right? Like something like Ocean Liner Designs or maybe some of these other niche people that I watch or whatever, like they're not get like they do well for what they do. They've been successful and they seem very grateful for that, but they're not organizing their content in such a way that it gets, you know, these enormous numbers, right? And that, you know, is obviously because they're operating in a completely different way with a completely different ethos that involves a completely different relationship and what they think their relationship is to the viewer. And who they think the viewer is and how they care about the viewer.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, we've always had, as far as like writers and whatnot, they've always had to consider the reader as well. So this isn't an exact like consideration of a creator to who is receiving it. I mean, I can think of art theories that basically center that as the sort of spine of any given art theory or theory or like philosophy of art. You know, I'm thinking like Tolstoy or someone like that. That's interesting, though.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's a nice little note, and it's nice to know that there are people out there working in present media who are trying to, as we kind of say before, bring out this sort of like what I like to call this sort of the new sincerity. You know, this a kind of care and concern and interest and sharing of knowledge that really is based on respect and treating viewers as like I said as friends and not vehicles for the utility of monetary and social and fame gain and whatever that might be.
Mm-hmm. I've wanted to do this experiment for a while just because I have never used TikTok. So I have a very blank algorithmic profile on there, but I think it would be interesting to download TikTok and then just swipe after every video for like an hour every day for like 2 months and just like don't stay on anything, just swipe and see what it throws at you, and it's just like, what do you want?
Yeah,
that would, yeah,
what
be
kind of what sort of profelicity is going on there? Mm-hmm. When you start to, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
should we jump, yeah, into should we go to the old Philosophy West?
Yeah.
in our
yeah
paper.
Yeah, so let's change gears from present media to something a little different. We're going to be reading through and discussing, as I mentioned, Jan Zwicky's eponymous essay, Once Upon a Time in the West, Heidegger and the Poets. Now, as I start reading this, you'll very quickly start to realize why Hale and I thought it would be a great idea for a reading episode. We've done reading episodes in the past. I know we did the Ion Live once even. But this one I think will be... Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Platonic... It's quite short, so made for good reading. But this essay essentially concerns a particular reading of the history of modern Western philosophy and how it got us into our particular predicament, right? Most of the essays, or essentially all of the essays in this collection, concern, so the subtitle of the work is Essays on the Politics of Thought and Imagination. So it's a work trying to communicate and speak to our present moment, right?
It says, as Once Upon a Time in the West, it's about Western philosophy, but it's written in the voice of kind of an old Western cowboy-y dialogue cadence. So which you will very much hear.
I've been hearing a lot about that Marty Heidegger lately. Ain't been in for a while, but he used to show up pretty regular. Didn't care much for his politics, but he was sure the best shot with a Mannlicher Schonauer I ever seed. What I've been hearing is mostly from poets, well, and folks as read poetry too, mostly about that primal speech therapy he was getting them into. Now, I sure agree the world would be a better place if we all thought it should be run by writers instead of being run by transnationals. My problems with what thinking of yourself as a poet the way Heidegger means it does to your ability to pay attention to things, to really listen to and look at the world, see her for how she is instead of what you want her to be. Well, I like to think, we all like to think we're doing our bit for the search posse, and Marty's giving the poet's egos a boost there, but if you really get what he's getting at, it's not quite so simple as thinking poets come up with a kinder, gentler way of running camp, and to really get what he's getting at, you gotta go back years. Hell, you could go back before these parts was ever opened up if you wanted the whole story, but you ain't got all night, have you? So I'll keep it short and start with what happened when Manny Kent got wind of that strike over on Dave Hume's place.
It's written as if we're chatting on the porch in the 1800s or late 1800s out in the West. And obviously Marty Heidegger is referencing Martin Heidegger, the mid-20th century thinker, who obviously emphasized poetry or a sort of poetic way of thinking as perhaps giving us, as kind of we were talking about earlier, allowing us to get to more some sort of kind of bedrock level of knowledge or experience, but also pointing out that, you know, how we got there